To pass the mic to Jay Kinney, editor of Gnosis Magazine, who's going to introduce Adam McClain.
Thank you. It's my great privilege to introduce our next speaker, who's Adam McClain, who I think of as one of the quiet workers laboring in the vineyards, who's been sort of reinvigorating the Western esoteric traditions. Adam, in case you're not aware, did some pioneer work starting, I think, around 1980 or so with the Hermetic Journal, which was a quarterly publication, which brought forth a lot of material on alchemy. Pardon me? Is that better? Okay. Adam founded the Hermetic Journal, which was instrumental in bringing forth a lot of material on alchemy, on Rosicrucianism, and on this whole area that we've been delving into this conference. He did that for 10 years, and then he's been primarily in recent years working with the Bibliotheca Philosophica Hermetica in Amsterdam, which is probably the single most extraordinary collection of Western esoteric texts, manuscripts, put together in one place. And he's been working for the library, doing research and bibliographies on alchemical collections in university libraries around the world, many of which have not been previously cataloged. So he's instrumental in making this material available again. In any event, it's my great pleasure to introduce this modest Scottish researcher.
Yes, the 1980s were for me really a time of publication and so on. The 1990s, I really have been able to devote myself entirely to research. And this is through the generosity of the Bibliotheca Philosophica Hermetica. I'm not going to say much about them here, but if anyone would like to know something more about their work, then just talk to me, you know, when you see me around. Although at first sight, Rosicrucianism might appear to have sprung unannounced into the world of early 17th century Europe, a bit like Pallas Athena, born in her full wisdom and maturity from the head of Zeus, creating a furore of speculation and fascinated interest amongst the learned, it becomes obvious on deeper investigation that the people who shaped Rosicrucian ideas drew heavily for their inspiration from the stream of the Hermetic tradition. Now, Francis Yates attempted to understand Rosicrucianism as arising out of the political, the social, philosophical, and religious currents of the late 16th and early 17th centuries. Some elements of the Yates thesis, as it became known, now look decidedly shaky. I mean, I find it quite surprising that I haven't heard any criticism of Yeats's views here, because the scholarly world has been looking at her work and finding problems with it. In a way, the sticky tape that holds bits and pieces together, you know, has been revealed. And this doesn't apply to most of them, but does it apply to the Rosicrucian Enlightenment? So I'm trying to address some of the problems of that here. In a way, I suppose she did not really give enough attention to the German origins of Rosicrucianism. And perhaps she rather expanded the term Rosicrucian in her book beyond its more narrow focus on the group of texts and the writers that we can recognize as forming the early Rosicrucians. And in this way, she encompassed a wider pan-European hermetic current in the early 17th century, in a way that it has made it impossible for her to give a solid Rosicrucian history that will stand up to precise investigation. Much of what she said would not be questioned if we substituted the word hermetic in her book, The Rosicrucian Enlightenment, for the word Rosicrucian. Now, my colleague in the Bibliotheca in Amsterdam, Dr. Carlos Gilly, has been researching the background to the Rosicrucians for the past 10 years. He's a scholar. I'll not go into all the details about him, but let's just say that he's been given the opportunity, 10 years of solid work, being allowed to go around all sorts of libraries and so on, in a quest for all the source documents, all the writings relevant to Rosicrucianism. And Carlos Gilly took an entirely different approach. He focused upon the exclusively Rosicrucian material, and he has now exhaustively documented the Rosicrucian phenomenon, showing the various personalities, the key texts that constitute the core of historical Rosicrucianism. Now, little of this material was actually available to Frances Yates in the late 60s and early 70s when she was researching and writing the Rosicrucian Enlightenment. I think once we see Carlos's work, one will realize that it provides a sure foundation on which future explorations of Rosicrucianism can proceed. A multi-volume work documenting all this source material will soon be issued by the library in Amsterdam. However, I might just mention that this year, the Bibliotheca has organized two major exhibitions of Rosicrucian source material. Earlier this year, the exhibition was at Wolfenbüttel, at a magnificent library called the Herzog August Bibliothek, which goes back right to the 17th century. And presently, it's been moved to the University Library in Amsterdam. And there's a catalogue of the exhibition. If any of you want to have a look at it, I'll leave a copy out. And it's really a documentation of all the key texts, etc. It's really out of works like this that, research like this that solid ground can be established for Rosicrucian studies. So, the earliest document of the Rosicrucians, the Fama Fraternitatis, was published in 1614, though copies were circulating in manuscript as early as 1610. In fact, there's an illustration of one here. In this key work, the image of the secret order of the Rosicrucians is carefully sculpted and revealed in an exciting story of its foundation. The Fama implies that the Rosicrucians had been around as a secret order hidden for over a century, and whose work was immediately to be revealed. The Fama uses two allegories to illustrate its foundation in the Hermetic tradition. The first is the story of how the founder, C.R., got his wisdom on a journey to the east, North Africa, the Middle East. It's not entirely clear where he went, but he got some kind of knowledge from there, and he brings it back to Europe. And this is, in a way, echoes the commonplace idea nowadays of the transmission of ancient Hermetic knowledge through the Arabic philosophers and scientists into medieval Europe. The other image of the transmission of Rosicrucian knowledge is through that of the vault of C.R. discovered by his later followers, full of secret knowledge, little cabinets with books and all sorts of things in, which, having recently been uncovered, must be revealed to Europe through the formation of a more public order. Now, we all know that the promises to reply to the letters from potential members of this new order were ignored. And after this clamor of the manifestos proclaiming the existence of the order and promising much to all of goodwill who replied, there was a complete silence. The focusing of the learned of Europe on the question of Rosicrucians during the second decade of the 17th century led many creative minds to explore the potentials of the Hermetic philosophy and generated a kind of explosion, as the image some people have used, of Hermetic Rosicrucian publication, revitalizing and expanding the domain of Hermetic ideas. Thus, alchemy, you know, grew and became an extended philosophical system, and we also recognize at the same time a kind of Hermetic mysticism coming to a maturity in the writings of Jakob Burma. So, we can view the appearance of the Rosicrucian manifestos acting as a kind of lens which focused the Hermetic ideas of the 16th, early 17th centuries into a new synthesis which seemed to the learned of the times to address the problems of their age. It's a tribute to the power of the archetype that was there unfolded that we can, some four centuries later, still see Rosicrucianism in a similar way as holding a potential for rebirth of ancient Hermetic ideas in our present age. The Fama mentions texts found in the vault, which one supposes to contain or encapsulate the Rosicrucian wisdom. Thus, the authors of the Fama clearly intended that their renewal or revitalizing of the arts and sciences should be seen to be based upon an earlier Hermetic tradition preserved in writing. The story in the Fama, if you recall, it even emphasizes the fact that there were different six groups of successors. And the third row of successors, supposedly writing the Fama, had little knowledge of the original Rosicrucian wisdom, except through writings, and I quote here, "Otherwise, we must confess that after the death of the said A, one of the earlier brothers, none of us had in any manner known anything of Brother R.C. or of his fellow brethren than that which was extant of them in our philosophical bibliotheca." So they had no knowledge that we don't have. They even gave special prominence to Paracelsus, whose writings are positively identified as being in harmony with Rosicrucian ideals, although simultaneously they strove to distance themselves from his methods and mannerisms. So, the Rosicrucians did not want to be seen as mere iconoclasts or revolutionaries, but intended rather to be perceived as preservers of a tradition of wisdom from past centuries. A parallel can be made here with the early 17th century publication of the alchemical works of Basil Valentine. During the first two decades of the 17th century, an important group of alchemical writings were published by an editor called Johann Tholen. Although these innovative pieces of alchemical literature could easily stand on their own, they're quite magnificent pieces of work, quite innovative, they were given a mystical charge by the claim that they were written two centuries earlier by a Benedictine monk called Basil Valentine. And they were hidden under a marble tablet behind the high altar of the Cathedral of Erfurt, and only recently uncovered. This idea clearly parallels the discovery of the vault of Prisian Rosenkreuz. At this time, other writers were using the same device. Dee and Kelly tell of their discovery of the red transmuting tincture at the ruins of Glastonbury Abbey. And it's this very tincture, in fact, that they brought over here and used in their transmutations in Prague. So, at this time, the late 16th, early 17th century, the first decade of the 17th century, the idea of something from the past being sealed and buried and newly uncovered somehow resonated with the spirit of the times and proved to be a heady recipe for capturing and focusing people's attention. Thus, Rosicrucianism in its foundation pays homage to and draws upon the Hermetic tradition of previous centuries. Many of the works that were later to be published during the explosion of Hermetic publications in the wake of the appearance of the Rosicrucian manifestos were inspired by the symbolism and texts of the 15th and 16th centuries. I just have a quick look at some of these texts. Some have been mentioned today. Even. There are, to my knowledge, actually only a handful of incunable books published before 1500. Which are directly relevant to Hermeticism. There's, of course, Ficino's translation of the Corpus Hermeticum. There's some works of Raymond Lull and Lactantius. And there's allegorical mentions of alchemy in the Roman de la Rose and the Hypnerotomachia. But before 1500, we have to recognize that alchemical ideas were transmitted only by means of manuscripts. There are a few works in manuscripts which appear to go back to Arabic source material, which was translated into Latin from about the 12th century onwards. A number of manuscripts surviving in the 13th, 14th centuries, which have definite Arabic precursors. And here we meet the names of Morienus, Avicenna, Khalid, Alphidius, Geber, Rhazes, and works like the Turba Philosophorum. So this layer of Hermetic material, it did really remain quite small, and it was also associated often with works on astrology, magic, and medicine. During the 15th century, a new creative phase of European Hermeticism results in the appearance of a number of original works and manuscripts dealing with symbolism in a new way. And this is not, you know, directly related. Some of these things do have some connection, I suppose, with the Florentine work, the working with the Hermetica, but Ficino and so on. But it parallels really that, and it comes from a different source. So, early in the 15th century, we see a number of manuscripts emerging. One of the most important of these is the book of the Holy Trinity, the Buch der Heiligen Dreifaltigkeit, which was written in German in about 1410, 1415, something like that. And it contained a series of emblematic colored drawings, which, among other things, they drew parallels between Christ and the Philosopher's Stone. And I know of 15 copies of this work in manuscript, not all from this early period. And the images were later printed as a series of woodcuts in a book called under the editor of Reusner called The Pandora, which came out in 1582. Another early work of alchemical symbolism is the Preciosissimum Donum Dei, the most precious gift of God. This is a series of 12 or 13 sometimes flasks in which the evolution of the white and red stones is pictorially described. Here we see the appearance of, at the end of the sequence, of a white queen and a white rose, and a red king and a red rose in the final two flasks. This work appears in the 15th century and is sometimes ascribed to a person called George Aurach, and it's sometimes dated 1475. No one has really collated these and found but it comes from roughly that. The series of flasks were also printed in the Pandora of 1582, and I have been able to find about 60 manuscripts existing of this work. So it was quite widely circulated, and later, a lot of these copies were made in the 17th, 18th century, so it was used for a few hundred years. The Aurora Consurgens, which we heard about this morning, is another early manuscript, possibly dating from the 14th century, was certainly not later than the early 15th. And this has a series of 38 or so magnificent allegorical colored drawings. Sadly, Marie-Louise von Franz, you know, did not include these in her translation of the text. But, well, left the best bit out, perhaps. There are 38 magnificent allegorical colored drawings, and there are about 16 manuscripts that have survived that I know of. The text is a series of parables and links together alchemical and Christian ideas. The text was later printed, without the illustrations, in fact, in two compendia of alchemy, the Artis Auriferae, the Art of Making Gold of 1572 and 1613, and another work by Grassoff called the inscrutable chemical philosophical harmony, or the concordance of the ancient philosophers, hitherto indeed most desired, but not yet sent out into the public light. And that was published by, printed by Lucas Jenis in 1625. So, we'll just now look at another work which was mentioned this morning, that's the Splendor Solis. This German manuscript appears in about 1532 and consists of a series of 22 illustrations. The copy in the British Library, though perhaps the best known, is in fact a later copy dated to 1582. The German copies are much earlier. 20 manuscripts are known to me, although of course they're not all of this early date. The work was ascribed to Salomon Trismosen, supposed to be the teacher of Paracelsus. But most likely, like we've seen with the Basil Valentine figure, an invented adept. In fact, the Splendor Solis is sometimes accredited to Ulrich Poissel, but very little is known about him, so it's not really that important. It was later printed with woodcuts of the illustrations in the Aureum Vellus, the Golden Fleece of 1598, which was actually reprinted in a came out in a series of different editions with different quality. Sometimes the illustrations were done much more scrappily, but for the next 10 years. So from about 1598 to 1610, I think there's four or five different editions. So it was caught the public imagination that book had to be reprinted. Thus we can see that in the last two decades of the 16th century and the first decade of the 17th century, many key works of Hermetic symbolism from the manuscript tradition of a century or more earlier were made public in printed versions. In a sense, I think we can find a parallel between the allegorical tale and the fama of the uncovering of spiritual wisdom in the past. The appearance of this material in the closing decades of the 16th century must have been like the opening of a time capsule. Perhaps it was this that led the authors of the fama to frame their allegory. At any rate, this idea resonated with the learned of Europe, and with the announcement that there was a society of philosophers who appeared to hold the key to unlocking this mass of symbolism, many seriously tried to make contact with the Rosicrucian Brotherhood. Of course, there was silence. How could any group have satisfied this clamor for enlightenment? Perhaps the authors of the fama actually planned to form a society, such a society, and change their minds when they were overwhelmed with the response. Or it may be that they only ever intended this as an allegorical statement of the principles of the renewal of knowledge. With the publication of the fama in 1614, whose conclusion requested people to join with the Brotherhood, and in the first instance to write to them, there appeared many pamphlets and books fueling the Rosicrucian frenzy. Now, my colleague Carlos Gilley has documented many hundreds of these responses to the Rosicrucian manifestos, which take the form of answering letters, missives, replies to the Brotherhood, epistolae, reports on the Brotherhood's activities, evidences of the Brotherhood, examinations of the points of their philosophy, elucidations of Rosicrucian matters, defenses of the Brotherhood, apologia, discourses, warnings against the Brotherhood, judgments on their work, deliberations, justifications, considerations, contemplations, all these marvelous titles they gave to these little pamphlets, prognostications about the Brotherhood's work, prophecies, echoes of their philosophy, instructions, advertisements. For the most part, these were published in German or Latin, some under the name of a real author, others pseudonymous, and others entirely anonymous, which seems very strange. But these were varied between a few pages, a single sheet, to quite substantial tomes, all in response to the Rosicrucians, always some way trying to get in contact with them, either by angering them, by stirring up points against them, or whatever. This all happened within a few years. However, this was not all. For the decade following the appearance of the Rosicrucian manifestos, saw a massive increase in Hermetic publication. If one draws a graph of publication of alchemical works, you see a definite peak during this period. And this was no doubt stimulated by the increased public appetite for this material. Many writers who had experienced difficulties in getting their works published now found sympathetic printers. Take the case of Robert Flood. Shortly after he had his Apologia Compendiaria, which is a brief apology for the Fraternity of the Rosy Cross, which he got published in 1615, just a year after the Fama was issued, he suddenly found it quite easy to get his vast tomes on the macrocosm and microcosm, which he had written some years earlier, but had not been published due to no printer being willing to cover the costs of the engraving, because Flood wanted a massive number of illustrations, which he felt were necessary in his work. At the same time, we see that another Rosicrucian apologist, Michael Meyer, had no difficulty in getting his stream of 17 titles published between 1614 and 1625. So, with this, the benefit of this perspective that I've kind of sketched out here, of the making public in print the Hermetic material from a century or more earlier, let's just look at some of the books that appeared in the wake of the Rosicrucian manifestos. And first, maybe we should try and place the chemical wedding into this picture. Although we can recognize that the Fama had a definite allegorical structure, it appears that many people at the time took it quite literally. This may have dismayed the writers of the Fama. The appearance of the Confessio a year later in 1615 only seemed to muddy things a little bit further, as it appeared to be rather a policy statement of the Rosicrucian Brotherhood, a kind of more secular work in a way, as opposed to the spiritual allegory and high inspiration of the Fama. Indeed, the Confessio is hardly ever analyzed or quoted from in the present day writings on this subject. It's the Fama which still holds our attention and fascination. The issuing of the chemical wedding, which is a profound extended alchemical allegory, wrapped up in an amusing and in places quite gripping tale, was perhaps intended to refocus the attention back onto the allegorical nature of the Rosicrucians. It even uses the device of appearing to have some pages missing at the end. Though in fact the authors made it absolutely sure that the story is entirely told. This echoes the Fama's incompleteness through its failure to keep its promise made in its closing paragraph, which is something like this. It says, "Nor anybody shall fail who gives but his name to speak with some of us, either by word of mouth or else if there be some let in writing." No one's going to fail to reach the Rosicrucians according to the Fama, but no one does. Andrea, the author of The Chemical Wedding, later dismissed it as a ludibrium, you know, not really a joke, but more a kind of a fanciful work, which in a way we can almost translate as in the sense of an allegory. Many people have tried to deconstruct the events and the motivations of those caught up in the Rosicrucian furore, and endeavored to find a historical interpretation of the Rosicrucian phenomenon. My own impulses are to stand aside from this, and instead I've tried to comprehend and appreciate the works which were issued during this period for their own content, rather than from placing them in some kind of context. Some of these are extremely well constructed, and many we have to recognize as allegorical and symbolic masterpieces. One early piece we might mention is Theophilus Schweighart's Speculum Sophicum Rhodosteroticum. Rhodosteroticum is the Greek for Rose Cross, really. So this can be roughly translated, the mirror of the wisdom of the Rose Cross, which was issued in 1618. Schweikart, of course, is a pseudonym and supposedly connected with Daniel Mögling. Some years I described this as in when I had it translated, issued it in the Hermetic Journal, I think it was originally. I described this as the fourth Rosicrucian Manifesto, really just to emphasize its importance in the sequence of Rosicrucian publications. The text clearly portrays the search for the Rosicrucian Brotherhood as being an inner quest. And it contains three large engravings, one of which is the wheeled castle of the Rosicrucians, which is everywhere and yet situated nowhere. And this has become especially well known, this image. Even in its time, this image was rather evocative and occasioned the playwright Ben Jonson, who had earlier written the satirical play The Alchemist in 1611. But Jonson poked fun at the Rosicrucians in one of his court masks, The Fortunate Isles of 1624. Know you not Outis? Outis was just some character that someone was looking for. Know you not Outis? Then you know nobody. The good old hermit that was said to dwell here in the forest without trees, that built the castle in the air where all the brethren Rhodostorotic live. It flies with wings and runs on wheels where Julian de Campus holds out the brandished blade. The fact that Jonson refers to this image clearly shows that he was confident that many of the courtly audience had knowledge enough of this illustration to get the joke. Like him, I have to have sufficient confidence in this audience's knowledge of the symbolism of the engraving to dispense with putting up a slide at this point. So Michael Meyer wrote a number of books during this period exploring Hermetic allegory and images from classical mythology. In 1618, he issued his Themis Aurea, The Laws of the Fraternity of the Rosy Cross, a work which does not really throw any new light upon the Brotherhood at all, but seems to be an extended commentary on elements from the Fama. In many people's minds, he's not just a Rosicrucian apologist, but someone close to the heart of Rosicrucianism. Now, a few years ago, I uncovered in Edinburgh a Christmas card. It's actually one of the earliest recorded Christmas cards. It's a large sheet of parchment written from Michael Meyer to King James I, late in 1611, just before the whole Palatinate marriage was being negotiated. At the center of this card is the symbol of a rose set on a pedestal of three steps. This is a drawing I made of it at the time. Look, you can look at it later on. I have a few copies, some you can take them away if you want. There are eight petals to this rose, and it has Latin text set out so as to form a series of eight concentric petals inside it. Robert Flood, of course, used a similar image in his Summum Bonum of 1629, the famous sevenfold rose. The rose gives honey to the bees, is the text around it. However, this famous icon of Rosicrucianism was in fact copied from an emblem book with no Rosicrucian connections, illustrated by Matthew Merriam of 1615. So, one can't always take things at face value. When I discovered this Meyer manuscript and its rose symbol, I wrote, in fact, to Frances Yates and sent her a copy of my drawing. She told me that while she was researching the Rosicrucian Enlightenment, a colleague had told her of the existence of this document and given her an idea of its contents. But she'd not been able to locate it and consequently decided, a bit reluctantly, not to mention it in her book. And this is, in fact, later, many people have just dismissed this as of no relevance to Rosicrucian history at all. but no one to my knowledge has made any detailed study of it. I'm still perplexed by this manuscript. Meyer, of course, is perhaps best known for his Atalanta Fugiens, which may be seen as, in a way, a kind of multimedia publication, uniting sound, text, and image, extending the concept of an emblem book through the introduction of music paralleling the emblems. Despite the resonance with the use of music and imagery in the castle of the chemical wedding, the Atalanta Fugiens has, I believe, really no internal connections with Rosicrucianism at all, though it's often held up as a key Rosicrucian work. A similar thing can be said for Robert Flood's vast encyclopedic survey of the knowledge of the macrocosm and the microcosm. Someone on first reading the Fama might be excused for jumping to the conclusion that Flood's work came out of the very vault itself, so to speak. I mean, we now realize that much of it was written before 1610, before the manifestos, the Rosicrucian manifestos, were apparently even conceived. A work often dragged into the Rosicrucian camp is the Amphitheatrum of the Amphitheatre of Eternal Wisdom of Heinrich Kunrat. And this was written before 1604, and a version containing the four circular diagrams without the text was issued in 1595, but a very few copies of that were printed, just a handful, I think. Three have survived, one in Basel, one in Wisconsin, in a collection of alchemical books by Denis Devine, and a version which has only two plates in it in the British Library. Anyone who has time in the British Library should really look at that. It's in the manuscript department, not in the printed books, but because it has a lot of manuscript additions to it. It's quite a marvelous thing. And in the center of some of these diamonds, there is a little mirror. So we return to the idea that when you enter into the symbolism, you see your own face. So it's a nice little conceit. So the full work, however, Kunrat's Amphitheatre, was published in 1609 with some additional large rectangular plates bearing symbolism which some writers have perceived as echoing the kind of symbolism of the Fama, the heptangular fortress, the College of the Mysteries, the gate of the amphitheatre with its kind of structure which echoes in a way the seven-sided vault. There are many works of great significance published during this Rosicrucian period. See Machel's Waterstone of the Wise, a very influential work which was first printed in 1619 and reprinted a number of times right into the 18th century. The Theatrum Chemicum itself, we mustn't forget that, published in 1602, four massive volumes containing 143 alchemical works. And that was published in 1602. Michael Spacher's Kabbalah Spiegel der Kunst und Nature, another much reprinted work, was issued in 1615, a whole series of editions right through into the late 17th century. The writings of Daniel Mylius. Mylius's work was, in a sense, an attempt at the reformation of the philosophy, and he particularly focused upon emblematic symbolism. His works contain many important series of symbolic figures, both original emblems and reworked material from earlier manuscripts and printed sources. For example, the Rosarium Philosophorum, the Donum Dei, and the so-called Azoth series of Basil Valentine, which was in 1602 or something. So we can see that many of the key works of this period cannot really be directly associated with Rosicrucianism at all, with the fact that what emerged out of the Fama and the people around that. But instead, it comes from the revitalizing of Hermetic publishing during the decade or so following the announcement of the Rosicrucians in the Fama. I think we can see that in pursuing the Rosicrucian phenomenon, we could take one of two interpretations. A strong view of Rosicrucian history, where we seek exact documentation to establish the links between a writer or his work with the Rosicrucian stream of material. and a weak interpretation in which we allow our concept of Rosicrucianism to defocus a little bit and apply the term more loosely to the renewal of Hermeticism in the early 17th century. It may even be, as I suggested earlier in this talk, that the authors of the Rosicrucian manifestos actually themselves held this weak view of their own activity. I find myself often shifting from one viewpoint to the other. I haven't really resolved the different perspectives within myself. And I suspect this applies to others who have tried to investigate historical Rosicrucianism. In fact, this talk itself really embodies many of these viewpoints. Knowing this, we should realize that although Francis Yates's thesis proclaims itself as a strong interpretation, in fact, it really takes a weaker line, expanding the term Rosicrucian too loosely to capture sufficient history to make it tenable to scholars of the present generation. So although we can criticize Francis Yates' Rosicrucian Enlightenment, her thesis, interpreted weakly, still remains a powerful and persuasive tool to investigate this period. And I suspect we really have to be able to work with these different interpretations simultaneously. Perhaps Rosicrucian history should be seen through a quantum metaphor. The more one focuses on the exact history, the more one loses the general view of the spiritual cohesion of the Hermetic revival of the time. And the more one relies on the conspiracy theoretical speculation and the undocumented associations between individuals, the more one feels one's feet slipping away from a foundation in real historical events. Depending on your temperament, the problem of balancing and resolving these polarities has either been the bane of the study of Rosicrucianism or its main delight. Now, I kept my talk deliberately quite short so to give people some time for questions. I've provoked maybe a few responses. Okay. he's part of the bits. I mean, there was something emerging at that time, as I kind of tried to present to you. And Frances Yates, of course, her work of Bruno is much more solid than her work on, I don't think it's really been severely criticized at all. And she shows clearly how Bruno contributed towards the Hermetic revival. Yes. Well, there's, I mean, with Francis Bacon, there's a divisive element, let's put it that way, of the Baconians who have emerged, I suppose, in the, I don't know when they first appeared, maybe it was in the 20th century, but trying to present Francis Bacon in a way which seems disconnected in a way from his actual real writings, you know. Baconianism, as Nick actually mentioned, I think, is that right? You mentioned Bacon. Yeah. Baconianism did have a profound influence on the 17th century, and however, the Baconians, as they're called, if you mean the people who emerged in the 20th century, believing that Francis Bacon was the author of the manifestos and so on, and supposed, author of various Shakespeare works. I mean, this is. Is that what you intend by your question? Or you just think of Francis Bacon? Well, I tend to work on the basis of facts. I can't really deal with the 20th century Baconians. But Bacon himself, of course, if you look at his writings, he has a plan, an ideal that he's setting forward. But it's really actually taking one quite a distance away from the romantic view of Rosicrucianism. Bacon is really a founder of what emerged later as, I suppose, as what we recognize as a scientific methodology. So once again, you have a character split belonging to different worlds, like Boyle and Newton later on in the century, people who were looking forward to a more exact science, and yet had their feet steeped in Hermetic stream. But if that's what you intend to ask about, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to really go on about 20th century Baconianism. Well, no, because what interests me is the fact that these manuscripts exist. These, you can find them, you can go and look at them, you can get photocopies of them, you can get, they all exist, and these are all the documentation of the early Rosicrucians. And no one really looks at them nowadays. And a lot of my work has been, when I was publishing stuff, I tried desperately to get people to actually look at something from some alchemical work they hadn't looked at before. And my view is that there's so much material there that no one really looks at. They all look at the secondary sources and commentaries and things coming from much later, which are really overlaying. And you're seeing Rosicrucianism through lots of sort of strange colored filters, filtered through different people's own world views. And I wish people would just get back to the original material and just look at that. You know? That's my thing. Because that, to me, it's a marvelous sort of stream of literature. And it just amazes me. My whole life has been about trying to get in touch with that stuff. You know, I don't really need to work on a speculative level. You know? Yeah? mean, I call Rosicrucian, I call, yeah, Bacon's New Atlantis, is it a Rosicrucian piece? I mean, I call Rosicrucian things that are connected directly to, you know, to Rosicrucianism. You know, lots of people, I mean, as I present, you know, as I said, all these writers like Mylius, Michael Meyer, they're writing works which we call Rosicrucian, but they're not, you know. That's the strong interpretation. If we use the weak interpretation, then we can bring in all these other things if you want. But perhaps we need a little bit of the strong interpretation. You know? Otherwise, we just defocus and everyone becomes a Rosicrucian. Everyone who mentions the word rose in a poem becomes a Rosicrucian. You know? It's nonsense. You know? I don't want to eliminate anybody. I just want to say, well, because there were a group of people, who were associated with writing the Rosicrucian manifestos, who wrote letters to each other, you know, who copied each other's manuscripts and eventually got these things printed. And these are the people who were, must be the Rosicrucians. I mean, they invented the thing. I don't think you can really draw up any sort of clear schema like that. Really. Well, do you know, can anyone give it to me? I've never seen it. Well, that begs the question because, I mean, people, these were literary people. They wrote things, you know, so there is written documents about. We can only go on those. We can't go on oral sort of traditions. I mean, oral traditions may apply to sort of, you know, Morris dancing or something, but where you're people who are dealing with books and bits of paper and things, you know, one has a... This is a written tradition. And those people love books, and the whole the myth in the Fama is all about a vault full of books and little cabinets with things in it. So they weren't whispering in each other's ears the secret instructions. I don't think so. Of course they are. I mean, do you believe if such a vault existed, you know, all these great collectors we've been hearing about, they'd have been down on it in a shot. And, I mean, no one could keep those things. There's a lovely bit in the Fama, I love it, where they open, a nail falls out of the wall when the old architect is doing up the building, you know. A nail falls out the wall and the plaster comes away, and eventually they clear it when they see through it a little, you know, they can see into the, you know, there's a door behind it, and they clear it all the way, and there's a little placard and everything after 120 years, etc. They open up, and then they say, well, we just left it that way, and, you know, till the next morning. Do you think anyone would leave it that way till the next morning? No. If you found a vault, you wouldn't seal it up again for, you know. People aren't any different today than they were in the early 17th century. And if you'd found a treasure like that, you wouldn't seal it up again. So I'm quite happy with Rosicrucianism as an allegory, because it's much better to work with in the 20th century. If it was just a load of old books in some castle on the hill somewhere, it wouldn't mean anything. It's the fact is the power of the Fama is that we still find it still revitalizes us today. It's the allegory that's important. Just a few people. You know, we've got, you could read the book. I mean, it's not. Yeah, you take a crack. We've only got a few minutes. Yeah, sure. I think we're going to close here, and we're going to rush. Some of us are going to rush off to Prague.
Don't go anywhere yet. I just need to make a.